Be seated, please. The court is ready to hear argument in 070135 East Texas Saltwater Disposal Company versus Richard Warline.
Please, the court. Mr. Smith will present argument for the petition.
Please, the court, and good morning, Your Honors. This case squarely presents the question of appellate jurisdiction over an order vacating and granting a rehearing of arbitration under the Texas Arbitration Act. The Court of Appeals in Texarkana held that the Texas Arbitration Act allows appellate review if such an order somewhere in the order also states that it denies confirmation of the order. In going to where that cannot be true and should not be held true by this court, I think we should begin with the common ground. And I would submit that that is in the jurisdictional statute, 171.098 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, in its subsection A5. A5 is the subsection that states that jurisdiction is conferred on an appellate court in the event of an order vacating without the direction of rehearing. From that, we should know that an order that vacates and grants rehearing, certainly if that's all it does, is not allowed jurisdiction. Because
it's just not in the list, but you can't logically infer from five that just because you can't appeal from a vacation without a rehearing, you can't appeal from a vacation with a rehearing. It just doesn't speak to the issue.
Your Honor, I would beg to disagree in this respect. And that is, first of all, that if you don't infer that, then the words without directing a rehearing have no effect.
And well, except that it might, they might be in there to clarify that if there is a vacation without a rehearing, you can't appeal. The writers might have thought.
Certainly, Your Honor, we recognize there are occasions when surplus words serve a function, and some statutes include
to call your attention to the fact that
yes,
this might
we don't think that's this circumstance, though, Your Honor. And also, if you'll consider it, that the statute construed in its entirety, and certainly the appellate jurisdictional provision construed in its entirety, with this one issue that we have here, it appears to confer appellate jurisdiction only in circumstances that align with the common law notion that appellate review is afforded from final decisions, and it's not afforded from interlocutory decisions.
It's not in the federal statute, the rehearing part.
Absolutely correct, Your Honor.
Which came first, the uniform laws or the federal statute?
My belief is that the Uniform Act, it was passed in 1955 or 56. I believe that preceded the federal act. And certainly all the states' decisions that are discussed in the briefing in this case, wherever they are from, they have statutes that have this similar provision, the vacate without directing a rehearing. If you begin with
none of the briefs try to explain any drafting history in this. I suppose you've looked for it and there just isn't any.
Your Honor, I hate to say that is true here. Maybe a better researcher than I could find it, but I certainly can't find it. Certainly the Texas legislature, there is no drafting history from our own state's legislature on this statute because they adopted this from a uniform act. They didn't specifically address this one provision. Now, if it is true that there's jurisdiction on appeal from an order merely vacating and no jurisdiction on appeal from an order that vacates and remands for a new arbitration, from that, it simply has to be the right decision as a policy matter that there also is no appellate jurisdiction if you fold in a what I believe gratuitous order that says confirmation is denied.
And this although if you're going to vacate and remand, you're not going to confirm.
That's absolutely right. And that is a premise of the argument, not the only premise, but a premise, is that simply the motion to confirm has been mooted by the fact that a rehearing has been granted.
It looks like that would give the trial judge just unreviewable power to force the parties to get a result that the trial judge wanted.
It is certainly the argument that is raised in this case by our opponents. It's an argument that is raised frequently by the proponents of review of new trial orders, new trials granted in the interest of justice. But several things can be said. Number one is it is a harm that's not evident in this case, certainly, and we suggest it's not evident in any other published case. You simply don't find a record where this is a problem, that trial courts repeatedly are sending things back to the arbitrator simply because they think the wrong party won.
There are a lot of cases that send it back for a rehearing because they didn't decide a couple of leftover issues.
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that's correct.
So I'm wondering if that's what the drafters had in mind here. Early example, there's five issues and the arbitrator addressed three, but they don't address two. The court can't make them up because y'all agreed to arbitrators, so we want a rehearing on undecided issues. You wouldn't want to be appealing that because the arbitration is just halfway over. But it does seem kind of different if you're tossing out the whole award and the arbitrator and saying we want somebody new. That does seem pretty final. Why wouldn't you want to review that?
Well, it's not final, and I would suppose this is a point of distinction from the situation of post-trial in the civil justice system. Regardless however you fall on the issue of whether a grant of new trial should be reviewable immediately, regardless of how you fall there, you shouldn't grant review in this case or any other case when a case is sent back for a new arbitration, and it's simply because of the
I think that the right analogy is not a new trial. An analogy for a new trial would be if the arbitrator issued an award and then the arbitrator decided I want to change my own award. The analogy would be to reverse and remand from the Court of Appeals. And if the Court of Appeals says we want to reverse and remand for a new award, that wouldn't stop us from reviewing what they did to see if it was right. And I'm just, you know, this is, I mean, what the bugaboo raised by the Court of Appeals, if you just wanted, what would keep a trial court from any case saying, I just think this arbitrator is impartial, I fire him and I get a new one? That would clearly subvert the party's agreement if the trial judge was just doing it because I don't like the award.
It clearly would, Your Honor.
And so what would stop it?
Your Honor, there may be nothing stopping him, but that was a legislative choice. It was a policy choice, and the legislature weighed that risk against...
They weighed that risk by adopting the Uniform Act without any discussion.
The draftsman of the Uniform Act. Maybe that's where
It strikes me that this particular instance is more like a motion for new trial because the trial court held that there was evidence of partiality, willful misconduct, gross mistake,
which
is sort of like a new trial saying jury misconduct. I mean, the trial court cited the fundamental reasons that it could vacate an award if it went back to a different arbitrator, which... you're arguing it should, and then that award was confirmed and it came up on appeal, there'd be nothing to preclude the Court of Appeals from reviewing whether the vacation of the first award was proper or not, correct?
That could be. That's certainly not posed in this case, but that issue, that could be true, Your Honor. And it's also correct, I believe, that at some point, regardless of this jurisdictional statute, there may be a role for mandamus to play. If, in fact, a trial court on the record says, wrong party won, send it back, and I'm going to keep sending it back until the right party wins, at some point, there may be a mandamus that's issued to stop this successive loop. But certainly that is not this case.
But arbitration is supposed to be faster and cheaper.
Maybe absolutely, Your Honor.
Maybe it isn't, but it's supposed to be. And it just seems to me that one party could wear another party out pretty easily by saying, well, Judge, just send this back. Make him do it again. But at some point, and maybe this fella is, but some fella is going to have to give up at some point.
That point is well taken, and that goes back to the weighing of policy issues that I spoke about. We believe the draftsman of this act weighed on the one hand the risk that trial courts might somehow initiate this successive loop harm against the fact of affording two layers of judicial review, be it in arbitrations. And they said when a trial court has said there has to be a new arbitration, when we know there will already be an arbitration proceeding, it would be a prudent matter, as a matter of policy, to say the arbitration will be more expeditious, cheaper, it will better effectuate the party's intentions than it would be to impose a second layer review, an appeal, in the process. Because after all, if the only way that the appeal can possibly be more efficient than the re-arbitration is, number one, if the appeal is quicker and cheaper than the re-arbitration, and number two, if the appeal reaches a preordained reversal of the trial court's decision. Otherwise, you're going to have arbitration, trial court's vacation, appeal, then new arbitration. So it just adds another level. It was a policy matter for the draftsman, and we believe that squarely, if you look at the language, vacating without directing a rehearing, that embodies that policy matter, that when a rehearing is granted, that the arbitration is not final. In fact, the arbitration is just beginning anew.
Counsel, practically, what occurs if the trial court remands and the arbitrator says, I stand on what I said?
Well, certainly that's not this case because we have a new arbitrator. I suppose we'd have to see what the trial court did after that. If the trial court issued the same ruling again, perhaps we're at the point in that case of a mandamus proceeding or some other proceeding, as Mr. Arbuckle, I think, said, where the court should initiate some kind of level of plenary review. But we're not at that juncture in this case.
Well, it's fair to say, perhaps, that the legislature presumed in 171.98A5 that a trial court would be honest in its assessment of directing a hearing.
Thank you, Judge O'Neill. That is absolutely correct. And that goes along with the inertia concept, I would say, behind all trial court judgments, generally at least.
Well, but I assume the trial judge will be equally honest in 1, 2, 3, and 4, but you can appeal those.
That's because those essentially end the game. If you can't appeal those, you never get an appeal recognized. Here, we're not saying there can never be an appeal. It's just that there can't be an appeal until the last word is writ by the arbitrators or in the arbitration.
What's before the trial court when, in a typical case, when he or she makes a decision on whether to confirm or remand or grant a rehearing? What's the record that the trial court sees? The proceedings are not transcribed. You get documents, or argument of counsel?
It certainly depends on the arbitration. Right. Some proceedings are transcribed. Most arbitration proceedings, I think, are not transcribed. And again, that goes, the thinking, I believe, is that that makes it less likely that the arbitration will be reversed goes towards the efficiency matter. But we don't know in every case that the proceedings are or aren't transcribed. Here, I believe, and I'm sure Mr. Wright will correct me, but I believe the proceedings I don't want to misspeak.
What I'm asking. What's the evidence of partiality, for example?
Well, the evidence of partiality simply goes to the fact of what this arbitrator did. The nature of it is that we have an employment agreement. We have a situation where the employee almost simultaneously says, I want a new title, a new position of vice president on the one hand, and then the very next day he says, I am deeming that I've been constructively discharged because I have that position. And so it doesn't make any kind of logical sense, the position underlying what the arbitrator did. And then number two, it's a matter of exceeding the scope of the arbitration. It was supposed to be, Your Honor, just simply an arbitration based on construction of the contract. We believe exceeded that to the nature of a quasi-tort.
Okay. Other questions? Thank you very much, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Wright will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, The Sixth Court of Appeals got construction of Section 171.098 of the Texas Arbitration Act correct. For the first time, a Texas court took a thorough, logical look at what had become of subsections A3 and A5.
Well, the court purported to rely on plain language, but
correct.
They chose one subsection of plain language. There's another subsection that has plain language as well that says there's no right of appeal. So you've got a statute that plainly says you can appeal, plainly you can't. And the only way to harmonize that is to say that vacating an award, directing a rehearing, is the same thing as denying confirmation.
I would disagree with the court's position in that regard. And I direct the court to the case, Court of Appeals case from Fort Worth, J.D. Edwards World versus Estes, that's cited in that case. And what the court's referring to is a situation that was presented by the 14th Court of Appeals in Prudential Securities versus Vonnegut's, which in that case the court said that A5 would be meaningless because denial of confirmation and an order vacating award are the same thing. In fact, they called it functional equivalence, which is a real cornerstone of the petitioner's case. They said A5 would never have meaning. Well, that's not what happened in the J.D. Edwards case out of Fort Worth. In that case, the arbitrator's award was vacated. No rehearing was ordered, and the appellate court was analyzing whether or not jurisdiction would lie to review that case, and they said it would. Now, it was a different case because the petitioners had presented the case as both a mandamus and a direct appeal under A5 because they didn't know which was correct. So the court was looking at the jurisdiction question under 171.098, and they said, of course, this is a situation where the statute, the plain language of the statute, there was a vacation of the arbitrator's award, there was no rehearing ordered, jurisdiction was found to apply. That's a real-world situation, as opposed to Vonnegut's, which
that's,
is...
That's not like here, though, because there wasn't a rehearing ordered there.
But in Vonnegut's, the court said the reason why we have to make this functional equivalent analogy is because denying confirmation and vacating the award are the same thing, and A5 would never have any meaning. The without ordering a rehearing section of A5 would never have any meaning if we don't treat it that way.
But what do you do in the situation that Justice Brister raised, where there are 5 points that the arbitrator is supposed to decide, the arbitrator decides 3? The trial court says, go back, decide the other 2. Why would we want that to come up through the appellate system under your argument?
We would look to the plain language of the statute and whether or not we had a denial of confirmation.
You presume a denied confirmation because
if it denied confirmation, then the plain language of the statute provides that we would have a basis to review that opinion. Now, and you're getting back to the functional equivalent.
But that's going to take a long time. In Judge O'Neill's example, when did the trial court issue its order?
In this case,
yes,
would have been in 2004.
So if 2004, if instead of doing this appeal, you'd have just gone back and done it a second time, and then come up and would have looked at both arbitration awards and said, was the trial judge wrong to do the first one? We probably could have gotten the case up here about as fast, except we'd have 2 arbitration awards to pick through.
Well, that's true, but it certainly doesn't promote the fundamental principles of arbitration of promoting efficiency and economy, because it makes no sense.
Well, but the whole reason that both acts, state and federal, say no appealing or order sending you to arbitration is because the assumption, right or wrong, is that no matter what happens in arbitration, an appeal to the courts will be slower. And that would seem to suggest that the right reading of this is no matter whether even if the trial court was wrong, shouldn't have vacated it, shouldn't have kicked out your arbitrator, shouldn't have kicked out your award, it'd be faster to go ahead and do it again and then look at it all at once than looking at it twice.
And my point in response to that, Justice Brister, is that wouldn't have been the case here, because we would have had to re-arbitrate the case, go back to the trial court.
How long did the arbitration take?
Took 3 full days.
Well, I know, but I mean, you know, you're talking about 3 years to get to this court on the appeal.
But if there is jurisdiction under the plain language of the statute, because the trial court's order denied confirmation, which it did, then we can have the trial court's action, which the Sixth Court of Appeals in the lower court here held that the trial court overstepped its bounds, substituted its judgment for the judgment of the arbitrator.
Which may be right, But if that's right, the trial court was wrong, shouldn't have ordered, but a new arbitration would have taken how long? 3 to 4 to 5 months?
I would only
gone back, and now the trial judge, assuming a bad trial judge, not this case, but assume there's a bad trial, okay, I like this award better, I'm affirming it. Then you appeal both of them. We've had a delay of 3 or 4 months rather than 3 or 4 years. What's wrong with that?
Because that's not what the statute says.
Well, but you say that, but why does subsection 5 not directly say you can't appeal if a rehearing's been ordered?
Because there is a difference between a denial of confirmation and a vacation
whether
of an arbitration.
Whether there is or there isn't. Subsection 5 says no.
Subsection 5 says that you may appeal an order that vacates an arbitrator's award without directing a rehearing.
Well, subsection 8 says you can. Well, but I mean, plainly, that means if a rehearing is directed, you can't.
If the order vacates the award and directs a rehearing, then there's no jurisdiction. If it fails to direct a rehearing, then there is jurisdiction. But A3 deals with confirmation.
All right, hang on. Here we directed a rehearing.
Correct.
So 5 says no. 3 says yes.
On that basis.
Of course. 3 says yes. 5 says no.
That's right. In this case, it's a separate basis for interlocutory jurisdiction. Well, that's if you adopt the functional equivalence argument. Justice Brister has...
Functional equivalence aside. I mean, I forget that concept. 5 says no, 3 says yes. How do you harmonize the two?
In this case, a portion of the statute provides a distinct, separate basis for appellate jurisdiction.
And a portion says no.
But where the legislature's act provides for jurisdiction in one instance, there may be other parts of the case that are not appealable. But the legislature says under A3 that where there's a denial of confirmation, you have appellate jurisdiction. A5 has meaning under other factual settings, as indicated by the J.D. World case. And in fact, I can think of an example that would even be more common where A5 would have meaning under a different factual setting than we have here. And that would be where neither party is satisfied with the award of the arbitrator. Nobody seeks confirmation. Which is really similar to what happened in J.D. World. We may not have a denial of confirmation.
What if the court vacates and, grants rehearing and refuses to deny? I mean, there's some of the parties seeking judge deny this confirmation award.
Well, first of all, that the fact that a court would refuse to rule on a properly presented pending motion is a problem for me because I think that in our court system, parties are entitled to have rulings. And so where a court refuses to rule on a denial...
You can get mandamus. If you file, you're entitled to a ruling, court just refuses to ever rule, at some point you can get mandamus.
That's exactly correct. And so under the plain language of the statute...
But what if the court, in the situation that Justice O'Neill posed before, that there are two matters that still need to be determined, and so the case comes on the arbitrator's decision and the judge says, well, this isn't done yet. Go back down. I'm sending it back
down. And if the court denies confirmation, there would be jurisdiction. However, that would not be the most thoughtful ruling for the trial court in that case where the arbitration was clearly incomplete. We don't have a final award. Then the proper ruling would be just to vacate the award and remand it for further.
So the judge says, on this record, because there's still two issues pending, I really can't confirm or deny confirmation. So I'm going to hold off on that ruling until these other two issues are decided.
And so there wouldn't be a denial of confirmation under that circumstance, and therefore, sending it back to arbitration, there would be no appellate jurisdiction, and we would get the proper result, which really is consistent with what Justice Brister was raising in the Bison case, which is that the functional equivalence misplaces the analogy. And that's the cornerstone of the petitioner's case. It's what Vonnegut relies on. It says that a denial... of confirmation and a vacation of the award are the same thing. The Stolhansky opinion out of the First Court of Appeals says it a little differently. It's something that Justice O'Neill mentioned as well. It says that vacating the award and ordering a new arbitration is the same thing as a new trial. And I would urge this court to recognize that that's not the case at all. They're not functional equivalents of each other because a trial court has much broader discretion to grant a new trial in ordinary litigation than they do to reverse or vacate an arbitrator's award. So they're really, it misplaces the analogy. The trial court is not the trial court. they're sitting as a first reviewing court or an appellate court, and they've got an extremely high standard of review. The standard of review is to treat the award of the arbitrator with the discretion or with the deference that would be given to a final judgment from a court of last resort. That's language from the J.J. Gregory case. There's a long list of Texas cases that takes that position. So really, as far as finality goes, the final judgment comes from the arbitrator, not from the trial court. The trial court is in the capacity of a reviewing court. And so to the extent that petitioners use a functional equivalent argument like the one set forth in Stolhansky to get to a finality and interlocutory appeals issue, it's a moot point if you put those analogies in the proper place. And that's all they are, is just analogies. And analogies are helpful, but they also sometimes
can you deny confirmation without doing something else? Seems to me if you deny, arbitrator gets an award, come to the trial court, the trial court refuses to confirm, you would either have to send it back to confirmation to arbitration, or you would have to say, as a matter of law, gross mistake, willful mis. Can you say, because of gross mistake, the law just doesn't allow this claim, and trial court just entered judgment? Or if you deny confirmation, do you always have to send it back?
Under 171.087, which is an earlier section of the Arbitration Act, that statute provides very clearly that in order to deny, what it says is that unless grounds are offered for vacating, modifying, or correcting an award, the court on application shall confirm it. So the answer to your question is no, you can't deny confirmation and do nothing else. The court has to do something. They have to indicate a basis for vacating the award. Now, if they vacate the award and they don't order a rehearing,
so it seems
we
to
have
me then
jurisdiction under A5.
Denying confirmation and sending it back to arbitration would be the same as vacating an award and directing a rehearing.
They have the same result, but they're not the same thing. It is a distinction with a difference, but despite what counsel would argue. The legislature and the Uniform Act treats confirmation and vacation as two different things. And, in fact, even the Vonnegut's opinion, relied upon by the petitioners, indicates on page 331 of that opinion that that except as to the parties requesting it, denial and vacation are functional equivalents, and that's where they use the term functional equivalents. Well, it is a distinction because the statute says it's distinct, that confirmation gets treated one way, vacating gets treated a different way. Are they similar? Of course they're similar. They end up with
a similar result. The difference would be if the denial has to send it back, one could completely subvert the party's arbitration agreement by just vacating the award and doing nothing. That seems to me then if they vacated an award and did nothing, you couldn't make the recalcitrant party go back to arbitration because there's no court order. An arbitrator can't throw you in jail if you don't show up. So if they just vacate and don't direct a rehearing, that needs to be appealable because otherwise nothing will happen.
But if they
do vacate and direct a rehearing, then that suggests there's no reason to appeal.
And under A5, if they vacate and they fail to order a rehearing, that's expressly appealable under the language of the statute, and that's what happened under the J.D. Edwards World case.
Why do you think that language was included in there? It's not in the FAA. Why do you think it's here?
Well, I would be speculating, and it is part of the Uniform Act, and most states include the same language. My speculation would be that the court intended, or the drafters did intend, to put the roles in their proper place. Consider an arbitration award where we get a final verdict, and where we have a vacation without a rehearing, we've got a problem. We don't have a final judgment in that case. And so that language is included under A5 to give the parties a remedy to get a new arbitration. What happens under the Vonnegut's functional equivalent theory and petitioner's theory, however, is we take that same phrase, without directing a rehearing, and we pencil it in A3. We're rewriting the statute. The problem with the flawed logic of the functional equivalent approach is that something is going to be rendered meaningless in that statute. But if you put the roles in their proper perspective, if you put the functional, the arbitrator is really the trial court. The trial court's really sitting in the capacity of a reviewing court. This is really more akin to a vacation, and new arbitration is more akin to a reverse and remand than it is to a new trial, which I think is certainly the logical conclusion. When you do all of that, the plain language of the statute works just perfectly. And we get jurisdiction for appellate purposes exactly when the statute says we should.
If the federal act applied here, and this was in federal court, there would be an appeal.
That's correct.
And we made some effort to harmonize these two arbitration procedures because so many agreements are under both.
Correct.
I know the parties have said this is governed by the state statute. Would it be governed by the federal statute, or the issues just never come up?
It's not, because it would need to be in the contract that they've adopted the federal statute, and it's not in the contract in this case.
You have to put it in the – and if it were in the contract, so that it would be covered by both, how would that – how do you see the conflict in the – federal statute and the state statute being resolved?
Well, if we want to try to get the two statutes harmonized, then we would want appellate jurisdiction to lie under the same circumstances, which in this case would mean appellate jurisdiction should lie because the court failed to confirm an award or they vacated an award, which under the federal statute provides a proper basis for jurisdiction. Under the state statute, under the Vondergolt's functional equivalent theory and the theory proposed by the petitioner, you wouldn't have jurisdiction because that theory says, look, denying confirmation is the same thing as vacating the award, and we're rendering A5 meaningless because they're the same thing, even though they're really not. So by torturing the statute, we've penciled in a new requirement that wouldn't exist under the federal law.
But in Anglin, we said interlocutory appeal is a matter for the legislature to grant for Texas courts, but we want to be able to review agreements covered by the federal statute the same way agreements covered by the state statute, so we're going to let that happen by mandamus. If this were covered by both the federal and state law, I guess, and they were different, I guess that would mean that the party could bring mandamus for a review as permitted by the federal statute, but not an appeal.
Well, I would be speculating, that which is what the court's asking me to do. But I suppose that would be the remedy regarding interlocutory nature of this appeal. However, I would add 171.098 is very clearly a legislature's indication of interlocutory appellate jurisdiction. A1, it provides that a party may appeal a judgment or decree denying an application to compel arbitration. Denying an application to compel arbitration. We do not have a final judgment in an appeal of an order denying an application to compel arbitration. Even A5 is very much interlocutory in nature. It says we have jurisdiction where a court's order vacates an award without directing a rehearing. The J.D. Edwards World case addressed that subject, and we don't have a final judgment because we've vacated the arbitrator's award. So it's very clear that 171.098 is intended to provide some interlocutory appellate jurisdiction. Petitioners would say, yeah, under A1 and A5, but not A3. Well, I fail to see where the legislature indicated a difference. The plain language of the statute, and by the way, this statute couldn't be any simpler. It doesn't have any big words or run-on sentences or a lot of commas. It's very simple and unambiguous, and it provides that an order confirming or denying confirmation provides for appellate jurisdiction. The Werlein Court cited this court in the Mega Child Care case to say that when the text of the statute is unambiguous, we're going to use the plain language of the statute unless it renders an absurd result. There's no absurd result here. So it's very clear that the plain language approach is the superior approach. It's our opinion that and belief that the Sixth Court got it correct and that this court should adopt the plain language approach and affirm the judgment of the Court of Appeals.
counsel. Thank you, counsel.
Can a denial of confirmation serve a function independent of itself? Yes, it can, under the statute. And that function is that, just like a vacation of itself, it can occur when the result is a determination by the trial court that the arbitrator, that the parties didn't agree to arbitrate. If you had that circumstance, I would suggest that vacation and denial are equivalent rulings, and a trial court could say, we vacate the arbitrator's ruling. We don't send it back to a new arbitration because there was no agreement to arbitrate. And the statute itself lends itself to that interpretation, and it's for this reason. The word denial only occurs in one place, and that's in the appellate jurisdictional statute. Otherwise, the statute talks about the available remedies being confirmation, vacation, modification, or correction. And I would suggest that, quite appropriately, the word denial is listed in the appellate jurisdictional statute kind of as a housekeeping mechanism, recognizing that a trial court could, I think properly, say when it intends to vacate the trial court's, the arbitrator's ruling on this basis that there is no agreement to arbitrate, it might say I'm denying confirmation as opposed to I'm vacating, or perhaps there was only one motion in front of the court and that was a motion to confirm. So that was its only vehicle to do it. That's not this case, and I would suggest to this court that when a trial court in its order has remanded for a new hearing, that in that circumstance, throwing in the word that I'm denying the motion to confirm has no effect. It does nothing whatsoever to the character and nature of the ruling. And two things follow because of that. They are this. First of all, if the court allows that superfluous event, that immateriality, to control whether or not the keys to the Court of Appeals are left open, it's as if you're building a financial system, say, on which conference wins the Super Bowl. You know, there's that wide deal held belief by some folks that if the NFC wins the Super Bowl, the market's going to go up. If the AFC wins, it's going to go down. I'd suggest that Bernanke shouldn't use that as a sound method to determine whether or not the Fed funds rate is going to go up.
Would this be, if this were in the federal system, would it be appealable?
If this were in federal court, mm-hmm. Yes, Your Honor, it would absolutely be appealable.
And under Anglin, we said if it's appealable in the federal system, we want to give it some review. In the state system, the only way we have of doing that is by mandamus. If this were in the state court but governed by the federal statute, does Anglin require that mandamus be available for review in this circumstance?
Not in this case, not at this time. And it simply is, first of all, I'd like to step back and say something about this overlay of the FAA over the TAA. Recognize that all the FAA really does and really intends to do, even when it applies, because it's a transaction involved in interstate commerce, is to say the state law is going to be preempted, but only to the extent that the state law impairs the fundamental purpose of preserving the party's intent to arbitrate the dispute. That's not at issue here, because come hell or high water, this case is going to be decided by arbitration. It's been sent back for a new arbitration.
In England, we said if you could appeal in the federal system, we're going to give you the same right of review in the state system. But we have to do it by mandamus because we can't create a right of appeal. And so does that mean if this were governed by the federal contract, you'd have statute, you'd have review by mandamus?
No, Your Honor, I still don't believe it does, and that's because, again, this overlay, what you would have is a statutory mandate that would read like this. The Texas Act still applies, even if the parties said the FAA is going to govern our agreement. The Texas Act still applies to the extent it's not preempted by the FAA. Assuming it's in a Texas court. Now, I'm assuming this is a proceeding that's in the Texas state system.
Right.
And the Texas Act includes Section 98. And Section 98 tells this court when there should be appellate review and when there shouldn't. And in that circumstance, I believe it would be wrong to essentially rewrite the statute by saying we're going to grant mandamus relief as a matter of course initially from that decision to vacate. Now,
and
there's
my last question on that subject is if it were only governed by the federal statute, that was our first case today, and not it, the agreement wouldn't comply with the Texas statute, would there be a right of review if the case was in the federal, in the state court?
Your Honor, that's where I differ from the litigants in the first case. I believe if the case originates in the state system, you cannot wring the TAA out of the case. All you have is, again, that overlay, and the only part of the TAA that's masked or that's ineffective, that doesn't rise up in the case, is the part that is preempted by the FAA. I believe that's what's required by the Mastro Blono case and some of the others by the U.S. Supreme Court, say, 8 or 9 or 10 years ago. It's simply not the truth that you can divorce a case in the state system from the TAA, regardless of whether the federal act applies or doesn't apply.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and that concludes the arguments for this morning, and the marshal will adjourn the court.
All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas.